The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.
The Bob Siegel Show is brought to you in part by Primetime Advertising Corporation and the law offices of Matthew Simone.
Recurring themes on The Bob Siegel Show can also be found in his Washington Times Communities column, Forbidden Siegel Talk.
It's time now for The Bob Siegel Show, a religious open forum where all questions are welcome. And now, here's your host, Christian apologist, Bob Siegel.
And this is Bob Siegel. So, you'd like to believe in God, but you keep hearing week after week a contradiction from this radio talk show host. On one hand, you hear him describe himself as a Christian, but often he has referred to himself as a Jew. Yes, I am a Jew and a Christian. I am a Jewish Christian. Some of you believe that's a contradiction in terms, but it isn't. What can I say? It just isn't. That can be proven beyond a shadow of a doubt from history. Christianity grew out of Judaism. God said he would make a new covenant with the Jews after their Messiah came. Christ and Messiah mean the same thing. A Jewish Christian is simply a Jew who believes that Jesus is the promised Messiah. Now, from time to time on this radio show, I stop, I take a deep breath, I travel down memory lane, and I review my testimony once again with this audience. How did a Reformed Jew become an evangelical Christian? That will be our subject on most of today's broadcast. First, the latest news. President Obama has referred to phony scandals once again, this time to a group of high school students in Phoenix, Arizona. Really? Even to high school students, Mr. President? You're going to lie even to them? Have you no shame, sir? Although the primary subject of the speech was America's housing market, this did not stop the president from taking advantage of another opportunity to plant effective talking points. He said, but for most of this year, an endless parade of distractions, political posturing, and phony scandals have shifted focus from what we need to do to shore up the middle class. And as Washington heads toward another budget debate, the stakes could not be higher. So far, now, in these speeches, the president has not stopped to list these phony scandals, but anyone who follows the news knows of a wide variety of subjects to choose from, including Benghazi, the AP Fox issue, Fast and Furious, and the IRS singling out the Tea Party and other conservative groups by making it difficult for them to get their tax-exempt status. Although President Obama now calls the alleged scandals phony, he sang quite a different tune when they first hit the news. At that time, grave concern was expressed. Regarding the IRS, President Obama said back in May of 2012, "The misconduct that it uncovered is inexcusable. It's inexcusable, and Americans are right to be angry about it, and I am angry about it. I will not tolerate this kind of behavior in any agency, but especially in the IRS, given the power that it has and the reach that it has into all of our lives." That was actually May of 2013 that he said that. But, you know, those do not sound like the words of a man describing some phony scandal. Similar expressions of anger were offered for each of the other newsmaking controversies. Perhaps the president felt free to express outrage early on in the hopes that no trails would lead back to him. On the other hand, in an ironic twist of fate, he may be benefiting from a plethora of scandals going on side by side. People have short attention spans. They also get easily overwhelmed. Too many problems at one time can turn American citizens numb to the point where they simply stop paying attention. You see, one juicy scandal like Watergate is captivating, but a whole list of seemingly unrelated matters gets tedious. It also lends itself to the possibility that Obama's enemies are simply making things up. Maybe his best defense for a multiplicity of scandals is to subtly suggest that too many accusations make the Republicans rather than the Democrats look suspicious. President Obama is aware of the human propensity for brainwashing. Perhaps calculated repetition is his best weapon right now. By repeating the phrase phony scandals as if it were some kind of mantra, he is offering the simplest solution to an otherwise complex series of problems. It may just work. This is Bob Siegel making the obvious obvious.
This is Lori K. Lewis, a frequent co-host on The Bob Siegel Show, Talk Radio 1170 on KCBQ. If you have questions or comments during this radio broadcast, please call Bob at this toll-free number, 1-888-344-1170. Again, the number is 1-888-344-1170. We'd like to hear what you have to say.
Welcome back to KCBQ 1170. I'm your host, Bob Siegel. They called themselves Jews for Jesus. I knew nothing about them. Absolutely nothing. And I knew nothing about Christianity itself. For that matter, even though I was raised Jewish, I knew nothing about Judaism. In fact, I grew up as an atheist. How can one have an atheistic background and a religious background at the same time? Well, allow me to correct one of the greatest misconceptions about Jews. It is often thought that they are a people who believe in the Old Testament, but not the New Testament. Nothing could be farther from the truth, and it was certainly not true of me. Actually, most Jews do not believe in either one, either Testament. Oh, many will claim to accept the Old Testament, but they don't. Not really. As you know, Christianity has three major sects. Judaism has three major sects. Christianity has about 150,000 different sects. In Judaism, they're called Reformed, Orthodox, and Conservative. Although the Orthodox Jews verbally ascribe to the Old Testament, or Holy Scriptures as they prefer to call it, in fact, they have a large set of commentaries entitled the Talmud and the Midrash, which interpret what these scriptures actually mean. Talmudic and Midrash teachings were originally handed down orally and were finally put to writing a number of years after the Romans destroyed Jerusalem. Eager, zealous Christians often show their Jewish friends some Old Testament prophecy, supposedly predicting the coming of the Messiah and allegedly fulfilled by Jesus. Much to their surprise, they hear the words, "That's your interpretation. Our wise rabbis over the years have told us what this really means." So yes, they are claiming to accept the Holy Scriptures as the Word of God, but what the rabbis say the Scriptures mean is what they mean. It's similar to Mormons, who say they believe in the Bible, but who really believe in Joseph Smith's interpretation of the Bible or the interpretation of their other prophets. With Reformed Judaism, the brand I was born into, theology is much simpler. Reformed Jews have more in common with liberal Christian denominations or members of the World Council of Churches than they do with the Bible. At a Reformed synagogue, the emphasis is kind of hit and miss. The rabbi may indeed expound upon some scriptural passage, but he's just as likely to preach about something he read in the newspaper. He or she views Judaism more as a community and less as a literal doctrine. You see, to many Jews, Judaism is every bit as much a culture as a religion, and to some, Judaism is only a culture. One can be an atheist and still be considered Jewish by a Reformed rabbi. I myself was raised by atheistic parents. Now, later in life, they did turn more religious, but while I was growing up, I heard from them that God did not exist. I heard from them that the Bible was a book of fairy tales. I was also taught that being Jewish was very important. My Jewish education informed me about Zionism and about the horrors of the Holocaust. I learned all about anti-Semitism. I learned nothing about God. To put it quite bluntly, as a Reformed Jew, I was taught by my parents that I may believe anything I wanted so long as it wasn't Jesus. Jesus, in fact, was a forbidden word in our household. If the subject even came up at the table, my father would shout, "I will not allow the name to be mentioned in this house." Now, in defense of my dad, his reaction was somewhat understandable. In history, from Constantine to Hitler, Jews have been forced from sword point to gun point to either convert or die. In fact, with the Nazis specifically, even Jews who became Christians were still put to death. Their racism knew no bounds. Now, here I was in the year 1973, 19 years old, staring at a Jews for Jesus poster on a college campus. Evidently, these dudes had come out to the campus to publicize their meetings. I had heard of the freaks, but I had never actually encountered them. Oh, sure, I had dialogued with a few other nutcase Christians, but I knew of Jews for Jesus only through name and rumor. Actually, I did not even witness their presence on this occasion. Maybe they had come by night to put up the poster. But however the poster got there, I was enraged by it. I thought Jews for Jesus were traitors. I thought Jews for Jesus were cowards, hoping to avoid future anti-Semitism by selling out. I also thought they were idiots. In fact, I thought anyone who made such a big hullabaloo about a man who had been dead for 2,000 years was naive at the very least and moronic at the very most. I was a commuter student at the time, living at home with my folks, experiencing my second year of San Jose City College, where I hoped to get my general ed out of the way before transferring to San Jose State University as a drama major. And this was the only field I knew, theater. Religion? I didn't know the Bible from the back of my hand, and like most people, this did not keep me from forming opinions about the Bible. Ironically, there was already a passage of scripture that applied to my arrogance. It's found in Proverbs chapter 18. It says, "A fool finds no pleasure in understanding, but delights in airing his own opinions." Are you catching the irony here? I knew nothing about Judaism or Christianity. I knew nothing about religion at all. But fools aren't interested in learning, only in expressing their opinions. And I expressed my opinion with extra finesse. I bought some construction paper and a great big felt pen, and then I made a sign of my own. I had never made a sign in my life, but I made this one, and I was quite proud of it. My sign, which I pinned up right next to Jews for Jesus, said, "How about people for people?" I thought the sign displayed unparalleled brilliance and philosophical wisdom. Still, had you asked me what my sign actually meant, I would not have been able to tell you. It looked good. It sounded good. It meant nothing. Absolutely nothing. Discussing the sign with two women students, friends whom I'd also known in high school, I told them how much the Jews for Jesus advertisement enraged me and how fed up I was with Christians who could not keep their stupid religion to themselves. I told these friends of mine I would rather go to hell than become a Christian, even though I did not believe hell actually existed. One day later, I committed my life to Jesus Christ. One week later, I went back to my lady friends and told them they should give their lives to Jesus. You should have seen the expressions on their faces. Their jaws dropped down so low they could suck marbles out of a gopher hole. How did my conversion come about so quickly? So dramatically, and against such tremendous odds? Well, something else much more troubling than a Jews for Jesus poster had invaded my blissful college life. Early one October morning, the year once again being 1973, the door to my room burst open, and I was awakened by my dad. "Get up! They've attacked Israel." Now, this was the morning of the Yom Kippur War, a day that lives in as much infamy as Pearl Harbor. It's a holy day, a day when Israel would hopefully be caught off guard, a day when surrounding Middle East nations attacked Israel unexpectedly. Right before my English class, sitting in the back of the room waiting for our professor to arrive, several of us were arguing about the war. Who was right, the Jews or the Arabs? I'll bet you can't guess which side I was on. My point was that after the European Holocaust, the Jews needed a national homeland. Now notice how I knew as little about Israel's modern history as its ancient history, because I was articulating a very naive, simplistic version of her natural rebirth. Be that as it may, as it happened, there was a Christian sitting next to me, not the weird holier-than-thou kind, just an average guy who actually talked in a normal tone and an intelligent manner. So different was he from any past encounter with religious baboons that he held my attention immediately. This guy, Peter, as I later learned his name was, he had a Bible with him. And no, Peter may not have been a typical Christian, but Peter sure did have a typical Bible. Leather-bound with gold-plated pages, you know, the works. He turned to Genesis and showed me the story of Ishmael and Isaac. If you know anything about that narrative, it's the story of the second Jew and supposedly the first Arab. He said, this is where the Jewish-Arab conflict began, not during World War II. It's been going on for thousands of years. Well, I was quite taken back. With serenity and in a down-to-earth manner, this student was referring to the Bible as if he was reading a textbook full of historical facts. I said, do you really believe all that stuff? And with a very sincere expression, Peter replied, I believe the Bible is the word of God. I says, you're kidding. Everything? Adam and Eve? Noah's Ark? All those fairy tales? Yes, everything. But he didn't sound like he believed it. That is, he didn't sound like he merely believed it. He sounded like he knew the Bible was true. How could that be? How could anyone be so sure? And I challenged him, how do you know it's the word of God? How do you know it wasn't just written by people? He says, I know because I have a personal relationship with God. I said, oh, you mean you pray? Well, I pray too. So what? And I was telling the truth. I did pray. Not to the God of the Bible, but to whatever God might be out there. Although raised as an atheist, I had promoted myself to an agnostic 2 years prior. And there are two kinds of agnostic. There are the ones who are uncertain as to whether or not any God exists at all. And then the ones who are convinced God exists, but are agnostic as to who this God is. I was the second sort of agnostic. Ironically, this was due to some supernatural occultism that I talked about in another radio show a few months ago, occultism that the Bible would actually condemn. Still, God is merciful, and I never got involved to the point of becoming enslaved by the demonic. Nevertheless, I did witness firsthand a vivid paranormal phenomenon that could not be explained away. As a result, I had long since come to the conclusion that some kind of God existed. But I was clueless as to who he happened to be, and I certainly wasn't expecting him to be the God of the Bible. Well, Peter responded to me. He says, it's not just prayer. God speaks to me. Just as he spoke to Abraham, just as he spoke to Moses, he speaks to me. Oh, folks, words do not exist to describe what I was feeling. I figured this guy was either a total nutcase who belonged in the loony bin, or he had made the greatest accomplishment of all time. There was no in-between. One thing was certain, Peter had definitely ignited my curiosity. I said, just for argument's sake, if I wanted to have this same relationship with God, where God talks to me too, how would I go about it? Well, he hesitated because he knew I was Jewish. He even squirmed in his seat. His voice was low and cautious. Finally, he said, actually, the way is through Jesus. It turned deathly silent. Neither of us said another word to each other. I went home that night, and I thought about all the Jesus people I had met. Never before had I engaged in a meaningful conversation with any of them. It was generally just some invitation to a meeting or some freakazoid handing out tracts. But I came to this conclusion. The Jesus freaks had something. Oh, sure, maybe it was all in their minds. Maybe it was all psychological. But here, in this crazy mixed-up world, there were people who talked as if they actually knew God. All my life, I had been taught that the one thing I must never do is believe in Jesus. If I were ever to make such a decision, my father would disown me. Of that, I had absolutely no doubt. And yet, now I was told that if I wanted to meet God, exploring Jesus was the one thing I needed to do. That night, before I went to bed, I made the following prayer. God, all my life I've heard about Jesus, but Jesus has been forbidden knowledge to me. If it's really possible to have a relationship with you, and if the only way is through Jesus, then show me how to do it. I know nothing about Jesus. A little second grader in Sunday school knows more about Jesus than I do, and I'm almost 20 years old. I have many questions about this controversial person. I don't even understand who he really is in relation to you. Please give me some answers. Never before had I opened myself to such a new way of thinking. Growing up in America as a Jew with mostly Gentile friends, I'd been exposed to Christian terminology all my life. Words such as sin, Savior, atonement, even the title Son of God. I really didn't understand what any of those spiritual phrases meant. And frankly, I hadn't cared enough to ask. But now I did care. Now I was seeking God desperately. Well, what can I say? God honored the prayer. In fact, he didn't even wait a full 24 hours. The very next day, after classes were over, I was sitting on one of the campus lawns close to a tree, sipping a can of Coca-Cola. Two guys came by with notebooks in their hands. I had never seen them before. They claimed they were taking a religious survey. Now, I was not that stupid, and I didn't believe them for a second. I knew this was going to be some kind of presentation about religion. The survey was an excuse to bring up the subject in a more tactful way, kind of a non-threatening buffer zone. Now, as I said before, my encounters with pushy Christians in the past were brief and marginal, but I could smell them a mile away. I must admit, though, I admired their ability to do it with a little tact this time, but I still wasn't fooled. On the other hand, this stuff had actually been on my mind as of late. Indeed, it seemed quite a coincidence that they should come along on the heels of my prayer from the previous night. I thought it might just be interesting at that to talk with these characters a little. It was the first time I could ever remember actually being interested in chatting with a couple of flaky Christians. Peter, from the day before, had been the first to get my attention, but even then, our conversation ended abruptly after he mentioned Jesus. Anyway, I pretended to go along with their religious survey. I agreed to speak with these college-age gentlemen who introduced themselves as Roger and Jim. I'll tell you about our conversation when we return to the Bob Siegel Show. This is Bob Siegel. They say a man's home is his castle. So when it comes to the wiring of your house, you don't want to mess around with some unknown electrician. Instead, do what I did. Call W&S Electric Incorporated. W&S specializes in both contracting and repair. From troubleshooting to remodeling to circuit breakers and fuses, W&S takes a skilled but personal interest in your home at affordable rates. I know the owner, Wayne Klingenhofer, personally, and I can testify firsthand to his integrity. Call 619-447-8785, that's 447-8785, for W&S Electric, Incorporated, license number 480-539, W&S Electric.
We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
I was almost 20 years old before I became a Christian. I was in my second year of college, and I met a guy in class who claimed he had a personal relationship with God. Not merely that he prayed to God, but that God spoke to him. That got my curiosity going, and I asked God to reveal himself to me if it was possible to have a relationship with him, but I had been told that that door was a door called Jesus Christ. And as a Jew, I was told that was the one door I must never cross. So I prayed to God. The very next day after making that prayer, I was sitting by myself on the college campus on the lawn drinking a Coca-Cola. Two guys named Roger and Jim came along, and they said they had a religious survey. They wanted to hear my views about religion and philosophy of life. Now, once again, I knew nothing about religion. Once again, that didn't keep me from speaking anyway, and I shared my bird brain viewpoints for an hour and a half. I would love to go back in time, be a fly on that tree, and listen to what words of ignorance proudly poured from my big, clueless mouth. Not to say that all of my rhetoric was pointless. I do remember one or two honest and truthful commentaries about life, because in the year before, completely separate from any thoughts about God or religion, I had made the observation that I was not a very good person. Now, this was a new and disturbing discovery, as I had certainly grown up thinking of myself as good. After all, I never broke the law, and I had no desire to do anybody any harm, but I really didn't care that much about people either. I was fairly callous and apathetic to the feelings of others outside of my own small circle of friends. Back in high school, there had been a girlfriend whom I thought I loved. But after she went away to see the world, or actually, she went away to college in Portland, Oregon, but actually she might as well have gone to the other side of the world as far as I was concerned, leaving me behind to attend some stale junior college in the dismal city I grew up with. And after she wrote that Dear John letter, okay, mine said Dear Bob, but I discovered a thin wall from this Dear John letter. I discovered a thin wall between love and hate. And I was more unhappy with myself than her because I had been sure I loved her. Now, because of the way I was feeling, I didn't know if I was even capable of loving anybody. I wondered if I truly cared about anything or anyone aside from myself. And I went back and re-examined even my good deeds. Even when I did good deeds, they seemed to have selfish motivations. While going through the checkout stands of supermarkets or drugstores, staring at those little gumball-type machines where you could drop in a few coins to cure cerebral palsy or something just as crippling, I would put in some money and pat myself on the back, and then moments later I asked myself if I really cared about the people I was helping or if I was merely trying to make myself feel better. Even in the sanctuary of a college world, I could not forget high school. Back in my freshman and sophomore high school years, I hated it when people put me down or made fun of me. Not being very good at sports, I was an easy mark. I tried to compensate with my involvement in theater, where I participated in a few school plays. My involvement with drama did serve to make me a tad bit more popular than I had been before, not so much for acting, but because I also displayed a talent for writing plays. In time, a fair amount of people who might never have hung out with me before were becoming friends. So what did I do after achieving a modest degree of acceptance? I started making fun of those other weirdos who were not accepted. I treated people the way I had once been treated. In the back of my mind, I knew this was wrong, but in high school, it's more important to be popular than to be ethical. Now, over a year removed from high school, my conscience had somehow magnified. I felt horrible about my hypocrisy. I did not feel like a very good person at all. My exploration into human nature was not limited to myself. I came to the conclusion that this negative side of my psyche was a flaw with human beings in general. My writing and my reading keyed in on this theme. I discovered why classic playwrights such as Arthur Miller achieved their well-deserved designation as geniuses, because they were honest about human nature. I wanted to write a play of my own, perhaps the first real play, perhaps the first play where I truly had something to say, and so I did. The play was born from my own pain. I called the piece Eternal Reach. Its theme, human nature and the meaning of life. I wrote this drama because I did not know the meaning of life, and I wondered how I could have lived almost 20 years without even once stopping and asking the question. Let me read to you an excerpt from this play. One of the characters says, "Each individual needs a feeling of superiority, competition, the knowledge that your best friend wishes he were you, a false self-respect created by traditions that have been drained into our culture. Actually, every person cares about himself and no one else. Acts of kindness and charity serve the giver's conscience more than the receiver's needs. Nobody really gives a hoot about his fellow man. Nobody really wants to work for another person. Nobody really likes to say and do things which he feels are ridiculous tools that contribute to senseless rivalry. But we do it anyway, because of sensitivity to our social status, which civilization has labeled important. That's from the play Eternal Reach. The character was David Miller, 19 years of age, loosely based on myself. Not that I had come to the conclusion that human beings were exclusively evil. Actually, it seemed to me as though we had two natures, an evil one and a good one. Later on in my play, the message became more optimistic. Here's another excerpt, this from a different character, an older gentleman, a psychologist. He says, David, we're talking about human beings, mysterious people, special creatures. All the world has obviously been given to us. Sure, the world is terrible, but the world is also wonderful. Both sides were evident for a reason. On one hand, life has the appearance of paradise. In nature, we see sunsets, seashores, snow-capped mountains. I could go on forever. But somehow this paradise has been invaded. Earthquakes, hurricanes, and disease display an incomprehensible dichotomy. It's like a beautiful beach destroyed by an ugly tidal wave. The dichotomy is also evident in the makeup of our very being. Look at the raw gut-level emotion. Okay, we have hatred, greed, selfishness, envy, but we also have music, poetry, senses for pleasure, and a mystical sixth sense. One that contains a conscience, our built-in awareness of right and wrong. One that searches for fulfillment. We fill the empty vacuum with temporal things, but what if it was meant to be plugged into something eternal? Something which makes perfect sense. Something which completes our thirst for value. Something which reveals the secret of our very existence. That's from the play Eternal Reach, the character of psychologist Dr. Edmund Hoffman. So yes, in this play that I was writing, I was ignorant about religion, but I had made a few painfully honest observations about life itself in this past year. Anyway, the two Christians with the survey listened patiently, and they seemed to be paying honest attention with considerable interest. When I finished, they asked if they could share with me what they believed. Well, what was I going to do? They'd been polite enough to listen to me for 90 minutes. I said, sure, I knew we were going to get to that sooner or later. At this time, in a friendly, logical manner, far more logical than I would have expected religion to sound, they shared with me how I might enter into a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. I'll give you my response when we return to the Bob Siegel Show.
Your kids ask you questions about God and the Bible that you can't answer? Sign yourself or your child up for a class with lots of solid answers at educateforlife.org before someone else gives them the wrong answers. Are you tired of not knowing what to say when your friends and family ask you questions about God and the Bible? Get equipped by signing up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone asks you, "How do you know the Bible's true?" do you say something like, "I just know it is"? If you're tired of giving lame answers, sign up for a class at educateforlife.org. When someone says that God isn't real, wouldn't it be fun to prove that He is? Quickly, like a verbal ninja? By using science and logic. Sign up for a class at educateforlife.org with Christian apologetics teacher Kevin Conover, and you'll learn how to do that. educateforlife.org.
When the truth is found to be lies, and all the joy within you dies, don't you want somebody to love? Don't you need somebody?
Sometimes when people think they're looking for love or meaning, they're really looking for God without realizing it. This was true of me when I was in college, but I didn't know it. I am sharing today with you the story of how I became a Christian. And I had asked God to give me some answers about Jesus because as a Jew, I grew up knowing nothing about him. The next day, two Christians came, took a religious survey, and we had left off where they were listening to a lot of my views about human nature and life. And then they asked if they could share with me how to enter into a relationship with God through Jesus Christ. They explained to me that this darker side of my nature, this flaw in human beings, which I'd spent so much time thinking about, reading about, and writing about, was a nature the Bible called sinful. I asked many questions. Their answers did not particularly persuade me, but I have to tell you, I was amazed that they even had answers. They spoke as if this stuff were true. They did not sound like men who had made a blind leap of faith. And I agreed to visit one of their campus Bible studies. That was pretty much it, or so I thought. The next part will sound totally bizarre, but it's absolutely the truth. After they left, I was bombarded by a supernatural presence. This was so unusual and so personal, it's difficult to put into words. Suffice it to say, I was aware that an intelligent entity of some sort was making contact with me, filling my body and soul with feelings of warmth and love. Since this came in the context of a discussion about Jesus, I wondered if I was experiencing the Spirit of God, whom I had heard about. Could this be what people meant when they claimed Jesus had come into their hearts? All at once, I thought about the prayer I had made the night before. How could I have thought about today's encounter so casually, as if it were a mere coincidence brought about by randomness and chance? God had certainly answered my prayer. Jesus had made contact with a Jewish skeptic who just the day before complained about how much he hated Christianity. At first, I said to myself, wow, this is great. Jesus died for that selfish part of my nature, which has plagued me this past year. It all makes sense now. Now I'll just continue with my life and my plans, but I'll always have an inner peace. Well, unbeknownst to me, this was only the very first short chapter to a wild adventure. Little did I know, my life was about to morph in directions I could never even dream. I was about to experience the first line from A Tale of Two Cities. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. Within only a matter of days, my life would never be the same again. On one hand, my conversion to Christianity seemed so sudden, a fantastic answer to a quick, desperate prayer, but it was also the culmination of an unconscious search that had been going on in my life for quite some time, especially the year before. It says in the book of Hebrews that God rewards those who earnestly seek him. And let me say it again. I'm convinced that when people say they are looking for love, joy, peace, or truth, they are really looking for God without realizing it. They are trying to fill an empty vacuum in their lives. They may hate organized religion. They may have grown up in the church, bored to death with the services and long sermons, taking the beliefs for granted, refusing to question them until some college professor later on in their life explains what nonsense it all was. Or they may be understandably disenchanted with the many Christian hypocrites they've met. Despite such handicaps, these very same people are still looking for the real God. Indeed, one who grows up amongst the religious may be farther from God than the most cynical of atheists. Since I did not grow up in the church, it was difficult to imagine Christianity playing much of a role in my life, even after my fantastic spiritual experience. In fact, even while Roger and Jim were talking to me, and even before the big epiphany, I remember throwing out three test statements just to see the reactions. I said, even if I were to buy into all this and invite Jesus into my heart, there are three things you will never catch me doing. First of all, I will never set foot in a church because the day I do that, my dad will disown me. Second, I will not spend time reading the Bible because I've read parts of it before. I found it confusing and boring. And I said, and third, I will never ever do what you people are doing now, going around telling other people about Jesus, because I believe people should keep their religions to themselves. They smiled and they spoke some practical words. They said, well, Bob, let's not put the cart before the horse. Right now, just concentrate on meeting Jesus. Why not accept him into your heart first and just see what happens? Oh, I saw what happened, all right. By the end of the week, I couldn't put the Bible down. I couldn't get enough of Christian fellowship, and I talked so much about Jesus, I made a woman cry in one of my English classes. And they weren't tears of joy, either. She got upset in reaction to a new zealous guy who never seemed to shut up about his newfound discovery and had no idea how idiotic he was coming across. I had all the tact of a rhino trying to put out a campfire. In fact, my English teacher made an unprecedented deal with me. No college student in history has ever been offered this deal. She promised that I would quit coming to class for just 2 whole weeks. She would not lower my grade. But I wasn't just talking about Jesus in class. I was talking about him everywhere, including the campus halls and the outdoor quads. My voice tends to project much louder than I am aware of, a trait I still have to this day. And I would think I was merely talking to one person about Jesus. All at once, I would look around and see a small crowd of individuals frozen, dead in their tracks, listening. Now, my parents weren't too overwhelmed by this decision. When my dad discovered my conversion, I was disowned, I was pronounced dead, and I was asked to leave home. Before telling my dad about my conversion to Christianity, I decided to warm up on my mom. I knew she'd be upset and I knew she'd yell, but she never yelled as loud as my dad. Nobody yelled as loud as my dad, and nobody was scarier than my dad. Mom was devastated. She did everything she could to talk me out of my decision. I tried to explain that I had encountered God in a mystical way, but any attempts to help Mom understand fell upon deaf ears. For her, it was emotional. For her, it was cultural. She exhibited a very common view of religion. Religion, to most people, is all about faith and all about choice. I was a Jew, and supposedly I should choose to remain a Jew. It was just that simple. In my mom's own words, if God wanted you to be a Christian, you would have been born one, not born again. My brother Paul, 2 years younger, took it better. He was open and receptive, but not long after my transformation, he embarked upon a 6-month trip to Israel. And although Paul had planned to work on a kibbutz, he ended up through a comedy of errors at a rabbinical school. When Paul returned home, he was no longer a liberal Jew, but an Orthodox Jew. His conversion came packaged with a new hostility toward my traitorous decision. Still, neither Paul nor my mom had any desire to disown me. My dad would feel differently, and I knew it. I was now attending Bible studies taught by Roger, the fellow who shared the gospel with me that first sunny afternoon at San Jose City College. He in turn introduced me to an oldest campus minister, an older guy named Bob Berger. Bob was in his 40s, and in those days, I thought a man in his 40s was really old. Now I'm in my 50s, I realize how mistaken I was about 40. Heck, now I even believe that 60 is young. But I'll tell you what 40-year-old Bob Berger said to me when we return.
If you enjoy listening to The Bob Siegel Show, check out Bob's weekly column for Washington Times Communities. Bob is also a regular contributor for San Diego Rostra and San Diego Newsroom. And don't forget his website, www.bobsiegel.net, S-I-E-G-E-L, bobsiegel.net. Here, you can download past radio shows, read Bob's many articles about Christianity, and get information about Bob's books. That's www.bobsiegel.net. We now return to the Bob Siegel Show.
I wasn't sure how to tell my dad that I'd become a Christian when I converted to Christianity out of a Jewish family. I knew he'd be upset. The fellow that was mentoring me, a guy named Bob Berger, kind of a father figure, he said, here's how you go about it, Bob. There's a tremendous change that's come over you since the Holy Spirit entered your life. And it's been a change for the better. Just wait. Your dad will soon approach you and tell you that he's noticed this change. He will ask you what has happened. That's when you tell him. Well, it didn't work exactly that way. Whenever I went to church or Bible studies, Dad simply assumed I was hanging out with my friends. One day, somebody from the church called my house and left him a message. Please tell Bob we'll be a little late picking him up for church today. Now, they knew they weren't supposed to call my house, but somebody had goofed. My dad put down the phone, ending a call I never knew about. It took him some time to admit to himself what must obviously be going on. Finally, he knocked on the door of my room and said he wanted to speak with me. He said, there's something I need to talk to you about, but I'm afraid you may not want to talk about it. Somebody called from a church to say they'd be late in picking you up. Now, I'm only going to question you once, and I want an honest answer. Have you been hanging around with the Jesus freaks? 3 months ago, I had been calling them Jesus freaks myself, but now those were fateful words, words which forever ended my relationship with my dad. He says, you don't even have to answer me. I can see it in your eyes. Dad ran into his room sobbing at the top of his lungs and crying out, you're dead, Robert. You're dead. I kept knocking on his door, offering to talk, begging him to let me explain, but we would never talk again. When my mother returned home from work, she pretended not to have known what had been going on with me for the past 3 months. She acted shocked and surprised. She asked me in front of my dad questions about why I had done this dreadful thing. She put on an Oscar-caliber performance. When she finally had a moment alone with me, she said that if I ever told Dad that she had known about this before him, she'd disown me too. On the other hand, I also saw Mom stand up to my dad for the first time in her life, shouting even louder than he. She said, you are not going to kick our son out of the house. Do you hear me? This was our fault. When he was growing up, he needed God. We never gave him God. My dad caved in and agreed to let me stay, but it only made matters worse. As far as he was concerned, I was no longer his son. He was serious when he said I was dead. My first few months of being a Christian had been wonderful up to now. I was so happy I would find myself singing in the car while driving. I would even give others the right of way, cheerfully. I worried about nothing. Life was exciting. It had never been so incredible. I had a heavenly Father who created me for his own loving reason, who had watched over me my entire life and recently introduced himself to me. It was the most fantastic feeling in the world, and it was going to last forever. Then the rug was pulled out from under my feet. The very best time in my life was followed by the very worst time in my life. The next 3 months of being a Christian were as wretched as one could imagine. My dad and I lived under the same roof, but he never spoke a word to me. If I entered the living room, he got up and walked out. Now, Dad sold real estate, and in time, he had to take an extended trip to Texas. He was going to be gone for, you guessed it, 3 months. This was evidently meant to be the season of three-month intervals. When he left, it was sad, but peaceful. I wrote him a letter before he headed for the airport and placed it in his luggage, explaining why I became a Christian, trying to make him understand that it was not done out of any disrespect for him or for the way he raised me. Dad never answered the letter, but my mom took me aside the day he left. She said, I want you to know that even though I disapprove of the choice you made, I on my own would never have made you leave home. But I just can't take this tension between you and your father anymore. He'll be in Texas for 3 months, and then he returns. This means you have 3 months to find another place to live. That same night, I walked out to my backyard and looked up at the stars. I said, God, what do I do? Where do I go? Once again, God didn't even wait a full 24 hours to answer my cry. The very next day, at church on a Sunday morning, I was approached by Charlene, one of the full-time church staff. Charlene was the Christian education director. Among other duties, she was organizing a summer day camp for elementary school-age kids. For this day camp, they needed 20-some full-time college-age counselors to work the entire summer, teaching classes on Bible, drama, crafts, etc. The activities would also involve field trips to amusement parks, camping, swimming, singing tacky little camp songs, you name it. I had applied for that job because I knew I would need to soon start paying my own way through college. And frankly, working with kids sounded better than flipping hamburgers at McDonald's. So I applied for this job quite some time ago. I had never heard back from anyone. I assumed I was turned down. I'd long since given up. Charlene handed me an envelope with a letter inside. She says, we sent this out to you a long time ago. For some reason, it was returned to us. Inside was my letter of acceptance for the First Baptist Church Day Camp of 1974. God provided similar jobs throughout my college years. Prior to becoming a Christian, I had been rather spoiled. No, our family was not rich, but we got by with reasonable comfort, and money was something I never really had to worry much about. Suddenly, I was out in the world, working my way through school, paying my own bills, doing my own laundry, cooking my own meals. Of course, by cooking, I mean things like, it says pull back foil to expose tater tots. God took great care of me during that turbulent and melancholy time of life. At first, I didn't understand why I was paying such a price for my decision. In time, I found that counting the cost was par for the course. It says in the book of 1 Peter, "Dear friends, do not be surprised at the painful trial you are suffering as though something strange were happening to you, but rejoice that you participate in the sufferings of Christ so that you may be overjoyed when his glory is revealed. And the God of all grace who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, after you have suffered a little while, will himself restore you and make you strong, firm, and steadfast." Well, if you would like to relate to any of this, you can reach me, questions@bobsiegel.net. That's questions@bobsiegel.net. Also, of course, you can reach us through Facebook, Twitter. Concerning my conversion to Christianity from Judaism, a fellow called Overdosium says, "And what if Jesus was Satan?" My friend, is that really your comment? What if I'm supposed to fall out of my chair because of a what if question? You can say what if about anything. What if John Wayne was really Madonna? He wasn't. But what if he was? What if Jesus was Satan? Well, my friend, if Jesus was Satan, then Jesus was Satan. As it happens, we don't have to deal with ifs. Jesus was not Satan. Carl says, "Praise the Lord for your testimony. We are witnesses to the world that the Messiah, Jesus Christ, died on the cross 2,000 years ago in Jerusalem and was raised from the dead 3 days later." Turbo says, "Bible is stories for Jews about Jews and in Jewland. Keep it that way. The Bible doesn't belong in Europe or America or any other non-Jew land." Oh, what a wonderful comment. Gee, I thought I was about to read a real comment by somebody who thinks about issues. Instead, all we got was the snake-like venom of a mindless anti-Semite. Now, some of you are wondering if I should talk that way since I'm a Christian. I understand your concern. Let me explain. You see, all I really meant to say that this guy has the snake-like venom of a mindless anti-Semite. Dan says, "Okay, so if my parents and grandparents are Muslim, but I believe in Jesus over Muhammad, I am still Muslim? That's ridiculous. Once you rescind your beliefs of a religion, you are no longer part of it. Unless you believe that Jewish people are a race and Muslims, Buddhists, and Christians aren't." Well, Dan, it all depends on the religion and what it teaches. Judaism is based upon a series of promises that would be fulfilled at the coming of the Messiah. If Jesus is the Messiah, I am no less Jewish for believing. By the way, Jews are a race, in addition to a religion, descendants of Abraham. Never do I hear people tell Jewish atheists that they aren't Jewish. Never. But when a Jew accepts the Messiah, oh, that's another story. Malone says, "If they are following Christ, it makes them Christians. They may be part of a Jewish family, and I agree you can't take that away from them, but followers of Christ are Christians. Jews believe the Messiah hasn't come." No, Malone, some Jews believe the Messiah hasn't come. Others, like me, believe he has come. Catching on? It doesn't matter how many of us are on each side. What matters are the facts. If you want to insist he hasn't come, provide the evidence. Daniel the prophet gave a prophetic calendar in the Old Testament of exactly when the Messiah would come. The day was March 30th, 33 AD. Only one person rode into Jerusalem that day claiming to be the Messiah, Jesus. So Jesus is the Messiah, or Daniel the prophet was a false prophet. Which is it? This guy calls himself Compassion. He says, "Too bad Jesus isn't for Jews. Heil Hitler, a.k.a. Messenger of Christ." Yeah, the atheists love to play that Hitler wild card. I'm so tired of it. Hitler was a Christian. They're talking about godless national socialism, but they're claiming Hitler was a Christian. Hitler was not a Christian. He was a pantheist and a follower of Friedrich Nietzsche, the philosopher who taught that God was dead. Hitler believed Jesus was the illegitimate son of a Roman soldier, but he didn't use the word illegitimate. And then Bob Burrow says, "Why do Christians like to use other people's identity? Why not say Jesus for Christians only?" Because, Barbaro, that statement makes absolutely no sense. Jesus came for everybody, Jew and Gentile alike. Christian is merely the name for somebody who has chosen to follow Christ regardless of his background. He didn't come to Christians. He came to anybody who would follow him. Christian is merely the name of the followers. We'll see you next week.
The Bob Siegel Show on KCBQ is sponsored by Bob Siegel.